This series of Let's Make It Rain is sponsored by PensionBee, a leading online pension provider. They're on a mission to make pensions simple so that customers all over the UK can become pension confident and save for a happy retirement. PensionBee's website and app make it simple for customers to combine their old pension pots, contribute flexibly, and withdraw their pension money all in one place. PensionBee offers a range of pension plans for different savings needs, from a flexible self-employed plan to socially responsible plans like their Impact Plan or Sharia Compliant Plan. Head to pensionbee.com or download the app to get started and become pension confident. Remember, when investing, your capital is at risk. And speaking of investing, you've probably heard me say before that we are our own biggest asset by far, and that includes investing in the next generation. I wrote Cash is Queen exclusively for preteen and teenage girls to equip them with everything they need to take control of their financial futures early. It's been translated into 5 languages and is available worldwide. So grab a copy for you and a friend today. Hi, and welcome to the Let's Make It Rain podcast. I'm your host, Davinia Tomlinson. This podcast is for the rainmakers. Those women who are breaking down walls, building their own empires, defying convention and rejecting stereotypes. Women who are unafraid to have open, honest conversations about money among friends and to share the truths we've been told to keep secret. Don't forget to subscribe, share and download wherever you usually get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, then please leave us a 5-star review. Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Let's Make It Rain podcast. Today I'm pleased to be joined by Dr. Stacey Moore. Stacey is an experienced doctor of psychology steeped in the foundations of learning, emotional intelligence and empathy, who believes that workplace well-being needs a systemic rather than individualized approach. I'll let Stacey explain more about that in a few minutes. Stacey is also a rainmaker. She is a mom of 2 very precious boys, one of whom is my godson, and she's also one of my very best and cherished friends. So Stacey, thank you so much for being here today. Can you tell us a bit more about yourself for the benefit of the listeners?
Oh, that's so lovely. What a lovely introduction. So yes, I am a psychologist and have been for the last almost 20 years now. Prior to that, I was a teacher and really have a passion for thinking about how we can educate people in so many different areas, be that about their brain and behavior, how they show up in the world, so that we can just really be the best versions of ourselves as we walk through life. I love travel. That's one of my things. I live in London at the moment, but I've got connections from the Caribbean. So Jamaica, big up Jamaica, any Jamaicans in the house.
Big up Jamaica.
And I am really interested in being more of a global citizen and just seeing what similarities and differences do we have around the world. I'm really passionate about culture and I'm fascinated by people. That's one of the things that led me to do what I do.
I love that. Gosh, you've said so much in there and now you've triggered my brain in a variety of different directions. So I've got a question for you that actually wasn't scripted, but now I really feel compelled to ask it, particularly in the context of workplace well-being and how we show up in the workplace, because I think obviously we share similar backgrounds being, well, originating, hailing from Birmingham, but being, you know, very much London lovers and London citizens, if you like. London can feel like a completely different country. If you're in the UK, you'll know what I mean. And I think for lots of us, we straddle or oscillate between different personas, don't we? Whether at work and at home, we wear different hats all the time. And particularly for people from certain ethnicities, from certain backgrounds, you are having to code switch. I was reading a brilliant book this week. I've read it before, but it's by W.E.B. Du Bois, who basically introduced this idea of a double consciousness. And I think this idea of having to, it's effectively you having to code switch, or who you have to show up as when you're among the majority, whether it be in your country, it might be, you know, a white majority, it might be a majority that are from a certain socioeconomic group or social class, whatever it looks like, you know, you're having to show up and kind of fit in to that environment. And then when you're at home, you are part of your own culture, you are part of your own community, and therefore you exhibit completely different traits. Perhaps you are more relaxed. You can take off the hat, you can take off a mask, let's say. And I've talked before about other guests on this podcast about the different masks that we feel we have to wear in the workplace and how that impacts us psychologically, from a self-esteem perspective, from a self-confidence perspective. It doesn't necessarily always have to be a negative impact, but I'm just interested in your perspective on that, particularly in the context of workplace wellbeing. How do you see that showing up for people in terms of all of these different identities and these different hats that we have to wear?
Yeah, that's a brilliant question. And it's steeped in the basis of social constructionism, which I really adhere to, this idea that we construct our identities through the interactions that we have. And that process occurs so many different times within our days. And like you said, there's different environments that can lead to different outcomes in terms of how we show up. All of that takes energy. All of that takes emotional bandwidth and effort. And it's interesting that you raised the idea of there being, you know, if you're part of a majority culture or minority culture, and that in itself, just having different, a level of hierarchy as to how we show up and how we're received by somebody else. And to go to your point about workplace wellbeing and how that shows up, our environments in which we spend so much time, the environments are shaped by the workplace culture. So to what extent does the culture of our workplace cherish the fact that we're coming in as individuals and have our own ways of being? And to what extent are we put upon by the workplace culture to shift how we show up? Even if it's to our individual detriment, if it's to the benefit of the workplace culture to be achieving particular targets or, you know, showing up with certain values in the world, I think that in itself is a really difficult road to navigate to ensure that we're still having a sense of personal identity, but we're showing up with the workplace culture or in the same way that the workplace culture would expect us to show up. It's a really difficult path to navigate. And inadvertently, that can lead to that dissonance between who we are and what the workplace wants us to be, or what the workplace culture tries to help us to conform to be. That dissonance between those two can really lead to, well, to mental ill health, really. Where there's a match, where there's a symbiosis between what the workplace requires of us and who we are, and that's in so many different domains, be it values, be that, you know, particular behaviors or things that we should be doing, then that's great. That's a match made in heaven. But where there's that dissonance, that can obviously lead to there being difficulties with how we perceive ourselves, how we show up, and our mental health.
I'm sure there are people listening that are kind of nodding away as you were speaking, because even as you were talking, my mind was kind of drifting away to some of the experiences that I've had over the course of my career, in which I have very much felt the and people wouldn't think it because it looks like I'm a radiator of high energy constantly, but it can be draining to be in those environments in which you perhaps don't feel that you fit. And then you are trying to conform, or in my case, not really trying to conform. But then there are, of course, the associated consequences of not conforming and just showing up as yourself every single day, recognizing that there is still a cost. There might be an emotional cost, there might be a mental cost that we all end up having to pay at some point or another, whether we defer that cost for a later date. And then how, presumably from your perspective, Stacey, you and other practitioners will see this showing up in poor mental health.
Absolutely, yeah.
So when we talk about workplace wellbeing more broadly then, just for people listening, what exactly do we mean by that? And whose responsibility is it?
Oh, that's a good question. So workplace wellbeing, we're still in the age that we employ humans, right? I know that we're in the dawn of technology and AI and everything else, but for the foreseeable future, we are valuing that humans show up to work and workplaces are made of people. When we consider that, the well-being of the individuals that we employ needs to be paramount. We know from psychology, but also just from common sense, that when we want to get the best out of people, we need to treat them well, right? They have to show up with their physical health intact. So if someone's broken their leg, we don't expect them to get yourself straight back into work and show up. But we need to consider mental health and well-being in a similar type of way. I know it's a bit of a cliche that, you know, if you've broken your leg, it's physical health and we need to consider mental health in the same way, but it's very true. So there is a responsibility upon a workplace where we're literally exchanging, we're trading people's time and existence for money in the workplace. There is a responsibility to ensure that these people are well, not only to show up for that day as part of the workforce, but to show up for the next few years and for their life in the broadest sense of the word, within their life, to be well, to do that and to keep going. The compromise is time for money, but what we shouldn't be doing is compromising people's mental health for money. We want people to be well. We've employed people. And so there's a duty and responsibility to ensure that we take the workforce in, they work for us, and then we send them out and they are still well. We haven't been to the detriment of their health as a workplace.
That makes sense. I mean, you can see how, and it made me laugh when you started by talking about, you know, we still employ humans. And I'm sure people will listen to this podcast and go, what on earth does she mean? But in years to come, this podcast, this episode will almost be like, it'll be a relic, because actually in reality, we will be seeing, you know, lots of roles, as we've seen happen already, be replaced by machines and technology, etc. But I think one of the things that has happened as society evolves, and of course, as industry evolves to match demand and the needs of the society, the prevailing society. So, you know, in the Industrial Revolution, for example, it would have been an occupational hazard if you're, you know, if you're sending people into factories and then there is some, you know, there are terrible accidents and you're losing staff members because, you know, the machines are not fit for purpose or you're not properly safeguarding your staff, then it's a problem. So you can see how employers, supervisors would have almost, even though I'm sure the staff members wouldn't have felt this way, but they're treating them, they have to treat them like gold. They have to make sure there are certain safeguards in place, because otherwise, if they cannot operate the machinery, then there is a problem. The business cannot run. So it's easy for people to make that direct correlation between staff must be in good, exactly as you say, good and optimum physical health in order to perform this work. Now, as we've moved more into a service-based economy, whereby, you know, people are having to show up and use their intellectual capital, you know, which is draining, you're not able to maybe perform tasks where previously perhaps in an assembly line format where you were responsible for your station and you do that to the best of your ability, then you move it to the next person along on the assembly line, for example. Now you're being pulled in, you know, a variety of different directions. Your mental resources are being drawn on all the time, but it's something that, because it cannot be seen, versus, as you say, you know, if someone's got a broken leg, someone's got a broken arm, they cannot operate the machine. Whereas now, well, you've got a broken arm, but your mind still works, seemingly. So therefore, you can still deliver that report. You can still do this work or that work. And there is a lot of pressure that people are under. Do you think then that when we consider, and I completely agree with what you say, you know, you need to, you know, employers need to make sure that they are looking after their staff within the workplace. And of course, they will have a commercial imperative for doing so, but there should also be a human compassion element too. And also that they're able to send them out still in one piece to their families, not completely broken. To what extent should we as individuals also be doing the things that we perhaps know we need to do, but that we defer to preserve and safeguard our own mental well-being? Because I'm sure you can attest to this as well, as women especially, for any rainmakers that are listening that are pulled in all the different directions and are trying to look after their children's mental well-being, for example, or you are a support for your partner and their mental well-being, what happens is we completely deprioritize our own. And again, it's back to this analogy that people are probably sick of, but the thing about putting your own oxygen mask on before you can help your children or anybody else. But we just, I think we laugh at it. I think as women, obviously our intellect would tell us, well, of course that makes sense, because if I faint, then I can't help anyone. But still, would we do it, or do we feel, are we racked with guilt when we do things to prioritize ourselves? What do you think we can do about that sort of mindset?
It's a conundrum, because as you were just talking about that, I just remembered getting in an Uber yesterday and I put my children's seatbelts on first before I put my own on. So as much as I'm a psychologist, I've done this for a very long time, there is still a natural tendency to take care of other people before ourselves and the people that matter the most to us than ourselves. Mm-hmm. there, I think over the last few years, there has been more of a shift towards understanding well-being. And if people were waiting for permission to do this, to put themselves first, I think employers have started to give that permission on the surface. On the intranet, you'll see the messages of mental health awareness days and well-being initiatives. So the permission is on the surface being put out there, but there is a responsibility to take that mantle up for ourselves. And also just to test out, what is it like when you are well, when you are optimum in your own domain? And doing small experiments for yourself, you know, if you do get a good night's sleep, how do you feel the next day? If you do go to the gym, if you do take a walk, and there are lots of apps at the moment, there have been for several years, and there are more and more coming out every year from Calm, Headspace, whatever. Once we take those responsibilities and try those things out, what is the feedback loop? How do we feel? It's our responsibility to make that judgment as to how our engagement with such resources enables us to then show up. There's a real propensity towards being far more self-aware nowadays than there ever has been. So the journaling culture, for example, just sitting down with yourself and reflecting, mindfulness, for example, all of those things give us the headspace to consider what it's like when we put our well-being first, and not being guilty of being optimal. It's going to take a massive shift, though, because although we've got the messages from workplaces that we need to take well-being seriously, in society, and just thinking about British culture, there is that propensity. You know, if you said, you know, how are you doing? What's going on? The person mm-hmm. that you're speaking to most likely is, oh, not bad, not bad. It's like, well, why are you not amazing? There are other cultures that would, you know, say, I'm awesome, you know, I'm incredible, I'm feeling great. And that was a pseudo-American accent for a reason. There are other cultures that I think are just far more open to being well, being psychologically and emotionally well, as opposed to there being kind of relishing in a culture that is, you know, sighing and we're all in the drudgery together. So I think,
yeah, no, I hear you.
There are some movements towards things being better and well-being taken more seriously and giving people permission to show up for themselves and take their well-being seriously. But I think on a cultural and societal level, there's still a way to go.
Yeah, I love that. And I mean, it's one of the things, there's so many wonderful, quirky, funny things about British culture. But you're quite right. I mean, this idea of wearing as a badge of honor your downtroddenness or never really wanting to, you know, something could be going brilliantly. You've got a promotion, you've bought a new house, you've just come back from holiday, and you'll ask a question. Yeah. And people are like, oh, yeah, it's all right, not bad. Yeah, you know, yeah, could be worse.
Could
and
be
it just,
worse.
Honestly, it has been stitches. It has been stitches. For anybody that is an Instagram user, please follow or just check out Very British Problems, because they encapsulate the way that we are so well, just in the way that we speak, the way that we, you know, we almost view it as vulgar, I think, to say, I'm awesome, or that's awesome, or I'm excited about that.
Oh, what's wrong with that?
Oh my gosh, and it's worse if you're a Brummie, as you will have just heard. But I'm interested in, because I think when you grow up with my kind of mindset, and again, this is when you're straddling different cultures, of course, you've got British culture, but you've also got Caribbean culture. And that was very much the dominant culture for the two of us, I would suggest growing up. Whilst we are much more, we are open, we are straightforward communicators. So this idea of saying, I'm not bad, when really you'd be like, actually, I'm not. No, I am bad, or this has happened, or that's happened. And sometimes you're thinking, oh, for God's sake, you might see someone, you know, when we were younger, you might see your mom or dad's friend somewhere, or maybe your grandparents' friends even. Let's leave it at that level of that generation. You would ask them, how are you? And then they're going to reel off all of their ailments. And you're thinking, oh, why couldn't you just say you're fine? I've literally only got 2 minutes. I've got to get on the bus because I've got to get to my Saturday job. I can't engage in this. And now I'm depressed because now you've told me about your hip replacement, your knee replacement, you've got cataracts. Oh, and also, did you hear that Pearl's daughter has done this or done that? And you're thinking, this is a lot. It's a lot to process in 90 seconds, right? So Caribbean culture, we are oversharers. One of the things, aren't we? I think for me, though, from a mindset perspective, in terms of how I show up and the things that I will share, I have almost, and it could be conditioned, it could be, it's part of my personality, but to view any kind of weakness as something that needs to be suppressed, dealt with, eliminated quickly.
Yeah.
And so almost revealing to somebody else that I couldn't do something or I was struggling with something or something was upsetting, I'd be like, absolutely not. And not even because I was intrinsically afraid that it might be used against me. That wasn't the issue. I was more worried about what it said about me as an individual. So my self-concept, the way that I defined myself, my identity was very much rooted in resilience, ambition, success, achievement, goal attainment, all of these things, which are then, of course, reinforced within your family. The more goals you achieve or attain, the more goals that, you know, they will fling in your direction, or, you know, the more successful you are, the more successful they think you should be. And so I don't blame my family, and I don't necessarily blame society for that, because there comes a point where you do have to take personal responsibility. But I think for people like that, it's easy for you to enter the, you know, whether it's the workplace or anywhere else, you can develop a kind of resistance to receiving support because you think it means I failed.
Yes.
What would you say to those individuals?
Yeah. It's moving into the space of self-reflection again, isn't it? And becoming more self-aware. And it's difficult to sit with yourself sometimes and unpick and understand where your certain responses to things have come from. But I think for all adults, it's essential to realize how we've got to the place that we have and what that story's about. I think for me, and I know that you will understand this in terms of completing my doctorate studies and juggling everything that I was juggling over the years that I did.
I think we need a pause and a round of applause for the completion of your doctorate studies. That's a frigging big deal. That is a mammoth achievement. So we're going to come back to it, but continue.
Thank you so much for that. And, you know, it's interesting. I raise it because I didn't think I was going to be particularly proud of myself when I finished it, because being an overachiever, being from the culture that you've described, Caribbean and British culture, and particularly the Caribbean side, why did I not do it quicker? Why were there issues in terms of completing it? Why was it so difficult to straddle that line? And I think you're right. In accepting the help, there becomes an unconscious acceptance that you are not the pinnacle of an overachiever that you have been cast as within your culture, within your family, or within your community. And I think if we allow that narrative to be the loudest one, of course, it's still there, it's part of our identity. If we allow that to be the loudest one, we're not going to have the celebrations, the things that we become proud of that can propel us and keep us going and moving forward. And we're not going to take the support that we need. And we're not going to give ourselves the grace that we need and the compassion that we need to complete things in a way that makes most sense for us without our mental health being compromised. But that narrative of, you know, we'll just dig deep and we'll just get something done. It's like, yes, that is entirely possible.
Yeah.
But what is the cost? And I think we haven't thought about
it. I mean, imagine one of my catchphrases that all the rainmakers would know, go hard or go home. I say that all the time to myself. Go hard or go home, Dad.
And sometimes that is entirely appropriate. And, you know, the cost is not that great. It might be, I don't know, whatever the cost is for you, that isn't that great. But, you know, there are some times when the cost actually is. The cost could be just far too many missed nights of sleep. And we all know how important sleep is. I think we forget actually, but we should really realize how important sleep is, not just in terms of it's good for us to get sleep so we don't feel tired the next day, but in forming memories. So our memory skills, our brain health, the regeneration of various organs in our body. You know, this is deep. This isn't just, oh, you know, miss a few days sleep, you'll be all right. Just, you know, go.
Yeah, I'm knackered. I've been burning the midnight oil, badge of honour. Yeah.
You know, burning the midnight oil for too long can lean to burnout. And burnout is, you know, a lot of people using these phrases recently. Burnout is one of them. But recovering from burnout, it is not it's not a simple thing. It's not just a, you know, I've got over my burnout. We're talking about a huge mammoth task of proportions that include your physiological health, your brain health, the neuroscience of your brain, as well as your mental health and your physical health. There's so much entwined in that. I think the other thing that culturally often people may do within the Caribbean is, and it's got us very far, and I can see why we do it as a survival instinct, is to make light of stuff, laugh it off. The funniest people that I've met in life are the ones that have had the harshest lives in my family and wider community. True. There are so many things that people just laugh about, and you're like, how is that fun? But it's a way.
Yeah, it's really
of,
warped.
It is.
It's a coping mechanism.
It is. And again, it's only stopping and reflecting on that and thinking, hold on a minute. Someone's referring to somebody as a particular name and everyone laughs about it. And it's like, oh, why are they doing it? Oh, it's a way of coping. It's a complete way of coping, laughing things off. And I hope that incrementally over time we get more headspace to be able to really dig deep and process stuff as it comes up, because when we shelve it, it has to come out somewhere else, whether that's again in our physiology or within our mental health later on down the line. There are so many stories that I've come across of people not being able to process what they need to process in the moment. And to some extent, that's okay. There's a justification of compartmentalizing and that being able to allow us to show up in the world. Whether that's going into work, we've had something happen to us and we have to then go into work because we just have, we've got bills to pay. We've got to show up for our job. But there's only a certain amount of time that you can shelve this stuff for. When I run my supervision groups, we talk about putting things into a box and putting it on the shelf, but be mindful that box is there. You can't shut the door of that cupboard and have it closed ad infinitum. There has to be a point that you feel sufficiently supported, stable, ready to open that door and open that box and confront those things that are in there. That is ultimately a part of workplace well-being as well. Asking people to dig deep and continue on that trajectory without dealing with the stuff that comes up. And it might be quite large life events that have come up, or it might just be, you know, minor incidents or seemingly minor incidents that have happened in an interaction with a manager where something has been said that's inappropriate. You know, those things have to be addressed to really create more psychological safety. And with psychological safety, we then have better workplace well-being.
I love that. And I love the analogy, anything that's visual like that, this analogy of the box and us just putting things in the box and then you put it on the shelf and you shut the door and you think, oh, that's it. I've sorted it. It's out of the way. I don't need to deal with it. It's a bit like having a box full of CDs or a box full of whatever. And you're like, oh gosh, I don't want to get rid of them, but I don't quite know what to do with it. So let me just leave it there for now. And it could just stay there for years. One of the things that I personally struggle with, so you can give me a bit of free therapy, is this idea of resilience, because you know me, you've known me since I was 17. And aww. I am somebody that, as I have said, I know it's wild, isn't it? 17. I gate crashed Stacey's 18th birthday party, y'all. That's why.
Yeah. No, I would not have life any way.
So for me, I've always prided myself on just getting on with everything. So carrying the full weight of everything and being proud about my ability to withstand pain, whether it's physical pain, emotional pain, you know, and truly, and it's interesting to put it in those terms, but actually it is withstanding pain. And I'm super clumsy, as you know, I'm bumping into things all the time, dropping things all the time. I've grown up and everyone in my family knows this about me, you know, breaking things all the time, TVs, tables, like just random things, just always in my own world, daydreaming and moving through the world in a constant daydream. And my family just giving me a lot of grace, actually. Yeah. My family giving me a lot of grace because people would be like, Dav's clumsy. And I'm like, yeah, ask anyone in my family. They're like, oh, yeah. Or that teapot. Yeah, Dav's broken the handle off it. That was just classic me. And at the same time, so obviously just getting quite used to the fact that, you know, things are breaking all the time, but it's fine. You just carry on. You just keep, you know, it's this. And maybe there is this element of British stoicism. You just keep going. Stiff upper lip. You just keep going. You carry on. I'm very interested. And of course, there came a point in my life when I became a mom. Suddenly, a I feel like I'm out of control of my life. I'm somebody that is very controlled about everything. So when I talk to the Rainmakers about you are in control of your money is not in control of you, that is a principle that I've adopted and adapted from my personal life. So your money is just an extension of that. Mm. I like to be fully in control of what's going on for me. When I became a mom, suddenly I'm like, oh my gosh, how are you in control? You've only just been born. You're only a day old and now you're in charge. I don't like that. I feel uncomfortable about that. And then of course, you know, they wear you down. You have no choice.
Yep.
Then going through a marital breakdown. And again, I'm like, oh, well, now I feel completely exposed because some of the hallmarks of my success, which included romantic success, I'm now publicly having to, and of course I don't have to take out an advert in the paper to say this, but, you know, suddenly I am publicly part of a marital breakdown. So then it's, you know, all of my, that's the rain in the background, everyone.
Well, it's appropriate, Rainmakers.
Suddenly I'm having to, I know the Rainmakers, very apt. My resilience has to kick in because I'm thinking now I'm responsible for two small children and I can't afford to be what I would consider quote unquote soft in this situation. I have to be strong for them. And then you come back to some of these stereotypical tropes, not just of women, but of Black women in particular. We can't betray any kind of what we would view as weakness, vulnerability, because resilience has to be the order of the day. How do you help people to find an appropriate fit when you think about that continuum from, and I don't know whether helpless is the right word, but the opposite of resilience, basically, on a line. What would you say? How do people know when it's okay to compartmentalize because they've got to keep going and it's a function of their survival, and when they need to actually say, no, I need help. It's okay for me to be vulnerable in this moment.
Yeah. I would initially say that part of resilience is being able to ask for help. I think that is a big part of resilience. I think we've been led to believe that resilience is about us individualistically turning up for things and getting through everything and overcoming whatever challenge we experience on our own. I would challenge that and say that is resilience, but it's not the only form of resilience. To really step outside of your comfort zone and think, I can traverse this particular thing with more of myself intact, with more of my mental health intact, if I turn for some help, if I lean into some help, that is the most resilient move that you can make. Because if you just take resilience as a measure of, some people call it bounce back ability or being able to bounce forward from a situation, within life, there's going to be so many different times that that has to happen, that you have to, you know, dig deep or really call upon your own mental bandwidth to move forward or traverse a challenge. So if we're doing that multiple times over the course of our life, it makes sense to find the support mechanisms that help you do that in every situation. And I'd also suggest that it's not about taking one route or the other. It's not about putting things into a box and closing the door or opening the door and processing everything at once. It is very much a continuum. So finding those punctuation marks where you can step off the challenge to get the nurture, the help, the support, and then going back into whatever challenge you're experiencing. I would suggest that that is the most appropriate way of traversing challenges in a resilient way. In a fully resilient way. I'd like to pick up also on something that you said about that badge of honor of going through the trenches and withstanding pain. And it's interesting you mentioned this because in some of the training that I've been doing with perinatal staff and mental health staff within the NHS alongside the motherhood group, we've been talking about this idea of particularly Black women having this strong Black woman trope. And it being such a seductive label that we lean into. And for many years, we lean into as being something that can help us move forward and feel confident and empowered and powerful. And within this training, we discuss the fact that hopefully we're getting to a point where women are embracing what we call hashtag soft life, of trying to see the value in the richness of our experiences and the breadth of our experiences in embodying a softer life rather than the real hard, able to withstand pain. Because yes, you might be able to, you know, dig deep and get something done, but my feelings from understanding, or my understanding of research, is that you can go further and be far more alive, well, and thriving if you do lean into more softness, more periods of softness, more periods of getting the support. There are certainly always going to be people for whom it is not appropriate to lean into for support. It is not appropriate or psychologically safe to lean in to get support from them. But you will know who your people are. You will know who your people are, where you can lean into them and get the support that you absolutely need to traverse whatever challenge that you're coming up against. And I think the work that we need to do to develop our resilience further is knowing the difference between the two and proactively ensuring that we have those support mechanisms put in place in advance of any challenges coming up, so that when they do happen, we're not alone. We're not at the point of, oh my gosh, our emotions have got to go everywhere and overspill into every single part of our lives. Or we've got to put them in a box and put them in a cupboard and lock them away. There's some sort of semblance of being along that continuum, and there being points where we can allow our emotions to be spoken about, and we can experience, you know, periods of softer life as well.
Oh my gosh, I love everything about what you've just said, because I mean, anybody that knows me, really, I'm such a sensitive soul. And I think it's funny that when you've worked in an industry, so obviously finance, and then the essence of your being has been about sprinting towards every opportunity, overcoming every challenge, and then that feeling like it's part of your identity, but then actually the cost, the emotional cost in lots of those situations is so high. And I'm having to bear this emotional cost, you know, individually. And it's one of those things, you take it home and you're dealing with it by yourself when you're alone. And it's heavy. It's heavy and the cost is high. And since I've embraced the idea of just being, Dav, yes, you are resilient, but also you are soft. Also, you are sensitive. Also, you are a radiator of good vibes, but also you like to be alone and be introspective. All of those different aspects of my personality, which might seemingly be at odds with one another, are actually the ingredients that alchemize to create the Rainmaker Dav. And I think it's important that we all, you know, identify within our own lives, what are the ingredients that make us rainmakers in our own lives? But, you know, you talked about the support mechanisms, identifying the support mechanisms in advance. And I think that's really important because, you know, to come back to the point about workplace well-being, I saw a report recently that highlighted the thousands of UK workers a month that are being signed off work with mental health concerns. Companies, we are now, I mean, of course, because it now has a direct impact on productivity, where previously perhaps, and I'm not, you know, bashing employers, but I believe it has forced employers to now recognize this can't just be something that we do as a nice to have employee benefit, mm-hmm. but something that has to be part of the fabric of our cultural DNA.
100%.
What are some of the interventions you would recommend to help companies? If anyone listening, there might be, you know, there are lots of rainmakers that run businesses. Perhaps they are running employee benefits departments. They might be employees of companies and have an ability to influence policy. Mm-hmm. What are some of the interventions from a practical perspective that you would recommend to help companies tackle this issue?
Yeah, I posted something earlier this week on that. There's a piece of research that's come out that talks about the tendency for companies to buy into individualistic employee benefits to tackle well-being and to show that they are supportive of employees' well-being. And this piece of research has come out to say that it makes not a blind bit of difference to long-term well-being
wow.
of employees. So those, you know, the employee benefits of coaching or counseling or gym memberships or, you know, all of those things that are centered on the individual. So I think it's a generalization. It's unfair to say it makes a blind, you know, not a blind bit of difference, but statistically, it does make some
difference. Yeah, because I used to like my gym membership, I have to say.
And that's fine. So it does make a difference on an individual level in terms of how you might show up. However, it doesn't make a difference in terms of over time, what your well-being is, what your there was a subjective score of well-being being used. It didn't make a statistically significant difference for those people in terms of how they showed up at work. The things that make the biggest difference are a combination of the two, of individual benefits, such as the things I just listed, coaching, counseling, gym memberships. But there has to be a systemic approach as well within the workplace, because otherwise you get into that dichotomy of a workplace creating the stress that then leads to people needing the gym. And so there's that analogy of you can kind of be pulling people out of the river, but you need to understand kind of who's throwing them in at the start. And there is a responsibility for workplaces to understand that you can be the creator of a lot of this stress that employees didn't have to start off with. We've got the 82% of managers, CMI just said, are accidental managers. You've got managers in management positions that are there because they've got the technical skills, not because they've got the management and people skills. And so in reflecting with my team around the things that we do within our work to show up in the workplace and support workplace well-being through creating more psychological safety, we devised something called the CIRCLES model. So we use this acronym of CIRCLES. So the C, talking about compassionate consultation. So as a manager or a leader, to what extent are you able to have truly compassionate consultation with your team, with your colleagues? Have you had training in that? And that doesn't happen as, you know, just as the norm. The I is about interactive factors. So people being really cognizant of how life events might impact on what's going on for people, how a restructure might impact, taking more time to understand how those interactive factors might impact on an employee's, on their ability to get their work done, on their efficiency. And it's only when we kind of start stepping into asking those questions, that's how we can start understanding more about how we can be of help and of service to employees. The R is about rights, reasonable adjustments and responsibilities. So there are things that organizations need to be mindful of. If there are vulnerabilities, specific vulnerabilities that employees have, are you compliant with what you should be doing for them? Are you making reasonable adjustments? I work in the space of perinatal mental health a lot. And so things such as, you know, are you aware that somebody's been on maternity leave and come back and they might need a bit of extra time to be able to go and breastfeed or express or those sorts of things? Have you got things in place that are looking at reasonable adjustments or the rights of your employees? The C is about community impact and involvement. There are some great things going on in organizations where you have groups that are set up to support people going through various things, whether it's people who've got neurodiversity or people who are parents or who've experienced a bereavement or they've experienced a divorce. There are great packages that employers create, and they create a sense of community and cohesion. And then the L talks about listening. So a lot of managers, as I said, are accidental managers, and they might be listening out for responses to the things that they're asking employees to do, but do they really have a grounding in really good quality listening skills, active listening skills that we as practitioners would do, as mental health practitioners would? Educate is for E. So managers clearly aren't psychologists, but it's about developing that ongoing literacy, and lots of the lunch and learn sessions that we do, consultancy that we have with companies, is about creating that education and awareness around what people experience when they're traversing life events. And then finally, S for support. I understand the stress that so many leaders and managers go through. Having reflective supervision with somebody, it's not necessarily coaching, but reflective supervision to understand the stresses that people are going through, is a really important part of so many different industries. And we've done this within schools as well as within corporate organizations. So creating that space, not necessarily from a line manager, but somebody external, to be able to offload and make sense of situations that people find themselves in. I think you're quite right, Davin, that you say that this isn't just, it's not just a good to have, it's incredibly important. And it's only in the last couple of years, I'm sure there've been lots of examples of this, unfortunately, but we've had significant deaths that are connected to mental ill health caused by workplaces I'm thinking the two that come to mind are Vanessa Ford from Pin St Mason's, that only happened this year. A real unfortunate situation where a lawyer was so overwhelmed with work that she sadly took her own life. And last year, Ruth Perry in 2023, Ruth Perry, who's a head teacher of a school, when Ofsted came around, sadly again, she took her own life. This isn't just a nice to have. This is essential stuff that has to shift in workplaces that have to take some responsibility for the way that they systemically support people to show up, not just as employees. We're not at the stage of the factory workers and we do it for the corporate gain or the commercial gain. It's about real life. There's a real moral imperative here to do things differently in workplaces.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, you've touched on so many things in there, but I mean, it's a really sobering thought when you think about the women that you highlighted in particular. And it definitely gives you cause for pause because you think, how could that have happened? And often they will interview people in the family and in the community who, in many respects, had no idea that those individuals are suffering. So it really is vital that where interventions can be made, that they are made from a preventative place rather than people having to suffer in the first place and feeling that there is no recourse for them to get the support that they need. So thank you for sharing that. I love circles. So just changing tack now and thinking about your personal finance journey, can you share with us, you know, when we think about, you know, even money and mental health, we know the relationship between poor financial health and our mental well-being. And all of us at one point or another in our lives will have experienced this. We will have, you know, unless you have been one of the lucky few, whether you have a lot, whether you have a little, you will have been in a situation in which money has been the source of some kind of tension, friction, angst in your life. And so, you know, we've explored that on a number of previous podcasts, but I'm interested in how that relationship might have shown up for you and, you know, your personal relationship with money in general.
Yeah.
Over time.
Right. So I think if I look back, one of the things that I think there's a lot of learning that can come from a regret. I think one of my biggest regrets is not buying a house when I was a teacher. And I raise this because my relationship with money at that point was, you know, things such as buying a house was a huge responsibility. It was shared with me as, you know, something that would be very burdensome, as opposed to something that would, you know, had I made that move when I was a teacher all those years ago, getting that house in Birmingham, that would have made a massive difference for how easy it was for me to get onto the property ladder later in life. So my relationship with money has been one of save money where you can, and every so often enjoy money, but it's something that there was never enough of. It was something that I was, you know, it was described to me that, you know, you have to be stacking your pennies, or it's one or the other. You can be having a great time or you can be saving money. And I think that that mentality was passed down to me from my grandparents' generation, in that they achieved something massive. And they were part of the Windrush generation. They came to the UK. And for years, I thought my nan was a nurse. I thought that's what she did. But she was a nursing auxiliary. And I say this because it makes her achievement in my mind, and I think to most people, it would make it even more exceptional, in that she, over the years, her and my granddad, they saved their money and they built their house back in Jamaica, and then they moved over there and they lived there for a good 14 years before she passed away. But it was at a cost. So we keep talking about this cost thing. What was the cost for her? The cost was, well, she never really went on holiday. She made sure that they were budgeting for things, and, you know, they didn't spend money on frivolous activities like going out to dinner or go, that, like, they didn't do that. And so, you know, my generation, maybe my parents' generation, and now increasingly me, we come along and we're like, oh, we want to go out for nice dinners, we want to go for weekend breaks, we want to go traveling. And I think for their generation, it would be seen as, okay, well, the cost of you doing that would be you're not going to ever achieve her example of building a house and then moving back and having this great accomplishment. But we're definitely in a generation now, and I would like to put myself there as a rainmaker, in that we can do both.
You absolutely are. Yes.
You know, so it's, we don't have to make that decision. We can do both, as long as it's not at the detriment of our mental health. But we can effectively have the abundance, because money's not running out anymore. You know, we are fortunate enough, or I'm fortunate enough, to be in a situation that my grandmother wasn't in that I have qualifications to fall back on and can build from there. You know, she was coming to the UK with qualifications that weren't necessarily recognised within the UK, and therefore had to do the job that she had to do. Different times and different ways of looking at money. And I'm hoping that over time, no, I'm not hoping that, I'm knowing that over time, I'm evolving the way that I look at money too.
Definitely. I love what you shared about there's a mindset shift as well. And also, you know, this principle of the opportunity cost, which, you know, how it shows up for you and how it showed up for your gran in terms of, you know, how she was budgeting her money and some of the privations that she was happy to bear. I don't want to say happy, that she was willing to bear in order to achieve a bigger goal. But we're of a generation now where our mindset is such that whilst we do recognize the importance of deferred gratification, equally there is more balance from the perspective of recognizing that money is not a finite resource, and that we don't necessarily need to hoard it or view it as something that's going to slip through our fingers and never be replaced, which I think is really important and something that, you know, we always stress within the Rainmaker community. So then, final question, and given everything that you've shared, you know, what does it mean to be a wealthy woman to you?
Is that balance? I could have all of the, oh gosh, I feel like I'm going into song. I could have all the riches in the world, but if I don't have, you know, my mental health intact, if I don't have the closeness and support of people around me, then that wealth is nothing. Wealth to me is abundance. It's about feeling safe, feeling secure, feeling safe enough to be creative and show up 100% as yourself. And to stretch the boundaries of what is seen to be achievable and what is seen to be a sensible goal, and being able to be audacious in the things that we may want to do in this life. And I'd conclude that by saying it's being kind of living a purposeful life. So whatever that purpose is, in at whatever point in time it is, because purposes shift and change, right? But being able to step into that purpose without fear. And that does take money. And, you know, coming from the caring professions, I think we were conditioned to believe, you know, money is not something that's going to be driving our careers. But if we think about a greater purpose, a lot of the time that does involve money, but it certainly involves more than money as well.
Thank you so much for that. One thing that we didn't get to touch on is creative expression and how that helps with your mental well-being, because I think, you know, what you just shared with regard to feeling safe to express yourself, for the purpose of the listeners, Stacey is actually an incredible artist. She produces beautiful paintings and artworks that actually she really should share, but I recognize that this is her, might be her own private ministry. But she is a brilliant artist, and performance artist. But in particular, I'm in awe of her painting skills, because I'm such a terrible artist in that respect. You know, my creativity comes through writing, but she's a brilliant artist and has been. I mean, she probably has been since she was a small child. So I think, you know, finding something that enables you to have creative expression is really vital as well. And I think as adults, it's easy for us to go down a path, you know, particularly if you are somebody that is so talented creatively. If you come from a culture or a background or a society that does not value creative expression versus your pursuit of financial wealth, then those ambitions, those desires can slowly start to fade, or you suppress them. Perhaps they never really fade. They burn brightly in your heart, but you feel afraid to express them publicly. Yeah. And so I would encourage anybody, you know, as adults, to still lean into play and to still lean into, you know, exploring something new, trying something new, because I can't paint, but if there's a paint and sip, I'm going to a paint and sip. I'm drinking my Prosecco and painting something. But I say all that to say, Stacey is a fantastic artist. And I think, you know, it's a lesson for us all really in our own endeavors to just find our own mode of creative expression too.
There's such a huge body of research in that area, just thinking about how we're able to show up in our, you know, day-to-day work, in the mundane stuff maybe. If you have an experience of play, where your brain is feeling able to be creative and play, you just show up far better for the mundane stuff or the stuff that is going to be earning your coin. So pepper your days with periods of play. And thank you for the reminder, Dav. I think when you're on that treadmill of doing stuff in life, you forget the skills or the talents that you have. And if you've got people around you, such as a friend that's known you from the age of 17, to remind you of the things that you're connected with, that's all for our betterment.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. So three quick fire questions then. Give me the first answer that comes to your mind.
Okay.
What's one money lesson you learned early on that you swear by?
Don't spend it all at once.
Money is no object. What are you blowing the budget on?
Travel, travel, and more travel.
And number three, the book, podcast, or discovery that changed my life is?
Would it be cheesy to say this one?
Which one?
This one.
Oh, this podcast.
Yes, this podcast. Would it be cheesy to say?
Sorry, when you said this one, I was like, this one.
So yeah, the podcast that changed my life is actually this one. I'm not going to lie. For such a long time, money has been something that you don't really talk about, or it's talked about in hushed quarters or in corners. And just having a podcast based on money that is fun, uplifting, talking about things like investing in art, which I adored, from connecting with your grandmother and thinking about intergenerational wealth. You've revolutionized my thinking in terms of money and what it's about and having further conversations about money. So yeah, this one, let's make it rain.
I love that. I love that for us. And of course, we had a big downpour in the middle of it. So I really feel like it's been raining blessings on us today. Stacey, thank you so much for your time today. Where can people find you, work with you, invite you to run a workshop or speak at their next conference?
Yeah.
Where should they connect?
The best place to find me is on LinkedIn. So I am Dr. Stacey Moore, CPsychol on LinkedIn. And the website innercircles.org.uk.
Wonderful. Dr. Stacey Moore, thank you so much for your time. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks so much for having me, Dav.
Hi everyone, Davinia here. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. If any of what you heard resonated and you'd like to find out more about how Raincheck is helping women all over the world build sustainable long-term wealth, then visit our website at raincheck.com and join the mailing list for more commentary, tips, and opinion on how you can start taking steps to leveling up your financial well-being today. You can follow us on social media at Raincheck, and don't forget to share, like, rate, review, and subscribe. See you next time.